From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. People in Beirut are angry today and demanding answers after more than 2,700 tons of high-density ammonium nitrate blew up Tuesday in the Lebanese capital. There's devastation, whole buildings gutted. The number killed is now more than 135. At least 5,000 more are wounded.
And officials are trying to figure out what's next for an area already in economic peril. CNN senior international correspondent Ben Wiedemann is on the phone from Beirut. And Ben, where are you? And tell us the latest on the effort to find survivors.
Now, I'm very near the port, Tanya, where the blast took place, right next to a building where every window has been blown out. And it appears that there's some scavengers taking the window frames and throwing them down into the street and then loading them onto a truck. As far as the rescue effort goes, they are still looking for people perhaps trapped under the rubble, the bodies of the dead. And every once in a while, they do find more bodies. But it does appear that we are approaching sort of final numbers. There are still tens missing, and their names are frequently read out on television for anybody who might have information. But really, the focus now is on the cleanup. And I must say, the effort is quite impressive. But the vast majority, the lion's share of the cleanup work is not being done by any government entity. It's ordinary people. It's NGOs who have gotten whatever brooms and shovels and whatever else they can get their hands on and are cleaning up. Cleaning up the mountains of broken glass and rubble that's strewn all over large parts of this city near the port.
I want to talk a little bit about what happened. People are pointing to government negligence as the reason for this explosion. They're very angry. Can you tell us more about that?
As far as we can tell, the problem is that a Russian ship was detained or seized in Beirut port in 2013. The owner abandoned it, or the man who leased it abandoned it, and this 2,750 metric tons of ammonium nitrate were put in a warehouse and essentially left there. The two heads of Lebanese customs did go to a judge and say, look, we need to get rid of this stuff somehow or other. But nobody ever took any action. And we don't know exactly what happened, but it exploded in some form or another. And so people are angry. It's just another case of negligence and incompetence on the part of a more or less dysfunctional government. And people want answers.
Port officials have been arrested. I mean, they're under house arrest. Are they now charged with anything, or will they be?
No, they haven't been charged with anything yet. It hasn't even been 48 hours since the blast. The investigation has just begun. And so this is something that we shall see. But the expectation is that some small fish, some small cogs in the machine will be charged and perhaps made to pay the price. The big fish, as is often the case here in Lebanon, will get away.
Hospitals in Lebanon are already dealing with a surge in COVID-19 cases. Now, as we're talking about more than 5,000 people wounded from this explosion, is the medical system overwhelmed at this point?
In fact, it was already overwhelmed before this happened because of COVID, but because of the lack of funds, the lack of hard currency. We were at the Rafik Hariri University Hospital a few weeks ago, interviewed the director of that hospital, who told us that they have an allowance for kerosene to run their generators, which normally lasts for a month. But because of 20-hour power cuts in one day, they basically used up almost the entire month's budget for kerosene in one day. And that sort of really underscores just how, at the end of the day, they need money. The money isn't there, and the demand, certainly after Tuesday's blast, is greater than ever.
Sure. You mentioned the NGOs out there helping. Tell us about international efforts to help. We know that French President Emmanuel Macron arrived in Beirut earlier today.
Yes, and he had a very clear message, a message that we also heard from the French foreign minister a few weeks ago, that for the international community to help Lebanon, Lebanon has to help itself fight corruption, make things work. We have 20-hour power cuts here sometimes. And the message is, get your house in order and we can maybe pitch in and help.
Yeah. So much devastation for a region already on the verge of collapse. That's CNN senior international correspondent Ben Wiedemann in Beirut. Thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure.
Well, now to New York, where the Manhattan District Attorney has subpoenaed the president's longtime lender, Deutsche Bank, according to the New York Times. The district attorney was already seeking the president's tax returns. The president has said he's done nothing wrong. But in a court filing this week, prosecutors cited public reports of possible criminal conduct within the Trump Organization. David Enrich, business investigations editor at the New York Times, is part of the team that broke the story, also author of Dark Tower, Deutsche Bank, Donald Trump, and an epic trail of destruction. David, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And the title of your book reflects what some might be thinking. You know, haven't we heard this before? Something about the president's favorite lender and accusations of wrongdoing. So explain. Deutsche Bank had lent the president more than $2 billion over a couple of decades. It has been subpoenaed by Congress before. This, again, is a Manhattan District Attorney. So why is this subpoena from the DA significant?
What's significant here is not so much that they've been subpoenaed as that they've actually complied with the subpoena. So there have been a lot of subpoenas issued to Deutsche Bank for Donald Trump's records. Trump has been very successful at delaying or just thwarting those subpoenas. In this case, though, last year the subpoenas were issued and Trump did not sue. He did not object. I'm not sure why. And Deutsche Bank spent months in the back half of last year handing over extensive documentation to the Manhattan District Attorney about Donald Trump's accounts and about the information that he provided as he sought loans and other financial commitments.
And you write that this seemed to be an investigation initially that started with a focus on those hush money payments in 2016 made to two women who claimed to have had affairs with Donald Trump. But this, as you say, points to a much broader investigation, possibly into insurance fraud. Can you talk more about, you know, all that information that these prosecutors have? What might they be investigating?
While we don't know the specific details of exactly what they're investigating, the DA's office this week in court hinted that among the things they're looking at is bank and insurance fraud. And I know, having spoken to people at Deutsche Bank who have seen these subpoenas, that the subpoenas to Deutsche Bank last year specifically cited any evidence that they have that might pertain to possible bank, insurance, or tax fraud. And the way that would work in theory is that, especially when you're trying to get a loan from a bank like Deutsche Bank, you might want to overstate the value of the real estate assets you have or other assets you have, because that allows you to get a bigger loan. And certainly in my experience, having spoken to a lot of people at Deutsche Bank that were involved in the decisions over lending money to Trump, their experience was that Trump routinely exaggerated his wealth and exaggerated the value of specific assets. And it was kind of a running joke for a while inside Deutsche Bank how Trump was such a serial exaggerator. And from a criminal standpoint, though, that can be problematic. It's not legal to deliberately mislead or attempt to defraud financial institutions. So I think that that is the bulk of what the district attorney is looking at, as far as we've been able to discern.
Well, we know that the DA is still trying to get the president's tax returns. The Supreme Court upheld their right to do so last month, but they left the door open for more challenges from the president. So what might happen? What shoes might fall in coming weeks and months?
Well, I think the DA's ability to get the tax returns is kind of the linchpin to this entire investigation, because the way that if they were to try and prove that Trump had defrauded banks or insurance companies, one of the ways they would do that is point out that the way he was valuing assets in his statements to the banks is different than what he was doing in his tax returns. So the conventional wisdom certainly is that the odds are good that the DA will eventually get the tax returns. And the broader question, just as a journalist for me, is whether this stuff will ever become public. And just because the DA gets the tax returns does not at all mean that they automatically become public. They'll be subject to grand jury secrecy rules, and they might only become public in the event of a criminal trial against Trump or his company or his family.
David Enrich, business investigations editor at the New York Times, author of Dark Towers, Deutsche Bank, Donald Trump, and An Epic Trail of Destruction. David, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
The music video for the hit song My Truck starts off like many country music videos. Country star Sam Hunt, with a wide-brimmed hat, walks through a cloud of dust.
You can drink my liquor, you can call my lady, you can take my money, you can smoke my blunt. Scuff these Jordans, you can say you hate me, you can call me crazy, but don't touch my truck.
Then a young black man appears with wire-brimmed glasses and a huge grin and shoves him out of the frame. That is Breland. At the start of this year, he was just a recent college graduate trying to break into music. Then My Truck blew up, and the song hit number one on Spotify's Viral 50 chart back in February. The music video now has over 24 million views and counting. Breland's music defies definition. He's country, trap, hip-hop, R&B, and so much more. And he joins us now from his home in Nashville to reflect on his music and his life as part of our series on how artists are reimagining and reflecting the current moment in their work. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. That was such a glowing introduction. I had to bring you with me everywhere now.
Oh, yeah, I'll do it. So, Breland, you're a recent college grad writing songs, trying to break down the doors of the music business. And then all of a sudden, you're going viral with this country song. What was it that actually got you to try your hand at country music?
I guess I'm always trying to do things that I think can push the boundaries. I don't like to feel stagnant. So this was came about as a challenge. I was in the studio with some friends of mine, and we were kind of talking about the new wave of kind of country crossover records that had been coming out, like Old Town Road. And I was just like, I feel like I could make a song like that and it would be pretty dope. And they were like, nah, man, you can't make a song like that. And I was like, okay, challenge accepted. So I just started, yeah. I just started working on it and was able to come up with something, I guess, that stuck with people.
You've mentioned other artists like Lil Nas, of course, with Old Town Road. We also know, though, about the massive debate over what country is and who country belongs to. What is country to you?
Country to me is a genre of music that is really just defined by strong songwriting and storytelling. I think anyone can make it. I think anyone can, you know, there are country music stars who are from other countries, you know, between, you know, Shania Twain and Keith Urban, and there are some others. And then it really just comes down to the music and then whether or not people accept you.
I want to deepen that a little bit, though, because the New York Times reports that My Truck isn't really picking up steam on traditional country music stations, which are known to be pretty conservative. Do you even care about that?
I mean, it would be nice to, you know, have gotten more country radio support. I think like Sirius XM, The Highway has played it a lot. But in terms of traditional country radio, I don't think we got any spins. I was hoping when I put Sam Hunt on the remix that would have hopefully validated it a little bit, but it wasn't quite enough. And I understand it, though, because if you listen to country radio, it tends to be white dudes over 40. So for me to be a 25-year-old black dude and I have a song with 808s and like hip-hop production on it, like it would have been a lot different than what was currently being played. My thing is, if all of these country music fans, or at least a lot of them who are under 30, for example, are also listening to like Drake and Migos and even like Ariana Grande and Doja Cat. Why do they have to leave the genre to get their fix of like bars and like hard beats? Like, I feel like, especially with after my truck came out, I realized that audience needs music, and I know how to make it, and I can kind of stand in my own lane and help carve out a subgenre of music that speaks to the millennial modern country fan.
I want to talk a little bit more about that music that's resonant with your fans. Your most recent work on your latest album, Rage and Sorrow, is about the recent Black Lives Matter protests. Let's listen.
I'm pissed off, really pissed off. So many names I could list off. How many more murders till it really hits y'all? What it means to be black and American. The fact that you can overlook the facts is embarrassing. It's twice the rate of police killings, no comparison. Took all this for y'all to act like you can, yeah. Moment of silence.
That's called A Message. And Breland, tell us a little bit more about writing this song.
Yeah, I wrote that the day after the murder of George Floyd, and I don't know, I wanted to be able to say something, and I wanted to be able to speak to how I was feeling and how I was seeing a lot of other people feeling. When you see something like that as a black person, but also just as a human being who has a heart and empathy in your heart, you know, like you can't see that and not be upset, you know, and I think it was kind of a breaking point for a lot of people. For me, I just wanted to be able to speak to it. I think I exist in a really interesting intersection as a black artist who is also making music that, you know, a lot of my listeners are country music fans. And so I figure if anyone is in a position to acknowledge this and actually be able to reach a lot of the people who we would want to educate on what's been going on, it's me.
At the end of this song, you're encouraging people to act with their money, ballot, or voice. Has this form of activism through your art always been a core of who you are?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I figure I only have a few songs out, you know, and so I kind of have the opportunity to define what it is that I stand for and what I stand on. And I figured this is an issue that has meant a lot to me historically. I live in America and in the South as a black dude. I have to contend with that reality on a daily basis. I just want people to be able to feel my pain, and I want people to be able to hear my passion. It's definitely a part of who I am. I'm happy to have been able to make that a part of my artistry as well. I wouldn't have been able to exist at this intersection of being black and being in country music and not address it, because the moment was too powerful.
Yeah. Okay, so more on Rage and Sorrow, a message about rage. And this next song is about sorrow. It's called Real Men Don't Cry.
Let them fall in private rooms. Had them back in quite a few. This kind of cycle's hard to fight. Broken dads and sons alike, holding on to shame and pride, trying to survive with us.
Breland, I want to talk about this song, but first, we have to acknowledge your range. I mean, you have real range, both in musical styles, emotion, your voice. What can't you do, really?
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, I've always kind of felt like part of the reason that we are in a lot of the situations that we're in, whether it's war or everyday violence or the way that people are policed, it really all kind of comes down to the toxicity of American masculinity, because men are socialized to bottle up their emotions. They're socialized to, if they're going to have a negative emotion, it's almost never going to present itself as sadness, which is actually a really positive emotion in the grand scheme of things, because your body, that's how your body gets things out. But instead, we turn to anger and violence and rage. And so this song, I felt like if I put out a song like a message, you know, where I'm speaking to this one side. And I think, you know, a controlled rage is important. It can be a really useful tool in protest. But I also think you have to find the time for self-care. You have to find the time for reflection and introspection. And you have to allow yourself to feel something deeper than just anger.
I have to ask about your social media. You did a whole virtual tour on Instagram Live. You're on TikTok, where just this week you published a song about your new apartment.
I got the new crib. I really went and got the new crib. No furniture, but it's a new crib. Still, let me show you the exclusive.
I want to see it too. Okay, so you're clearly having tons of fun on social media. You know, one thing that really struck me is that you've bypassed the gatekeepers. You know, the music labels, the industry puts people in a box. And so what you've been able to do is really defy that box or avoid that box to be able to tap into all of these different genres and ways of connecting with your audience. Who do you envision you're talking to?
I feel like I'm just talking to, people. I think, you know, I think there are old Black people, young Asian people, middle-aged white people, and every combination of any identity group that could listen to my music. And I feel like everyone is welcome to do that. And I try to create a safe and brave space for people to help break out of their own boxes or the boxes that society has tried to put them in. So I think that's kind of who I'm talking to on a daily basis, and that's kind of what I've seen in the way that a lot of my stuff has been received.
Breland, thank you for this conversation.
Thank you for having me.
That's genre-breaking singer and songwriter Breland, and we will have more music for you to listen to at hereandnow.org.
Don't touch my track.
And let's check in on the pandemic in India, where the number of cases is surging. Nearly 2 million people have tested positive. That's the third highest in the world. The BBC's Davina Gupta is on Skype in Delhi and joins us now. Welcome.
Well, hi, Tanya, and thank you so much for connecting. And let me just put these numbers in perspective a bit. For the past 7 days, almost a week, we've seen that the number of infection each day has gone up above 50,000, and that's a worrying sign. We've also seen some high-profile cases with the country's home minister tested positive. The worrying part is that the smaller cities are now seeing an upsurge. I can see that because I'm in Delhi. April and May, the number of cases were going up so rapidly that there was a worry at one point. Hospitals don't have enough bed or ventilators for those who are checking in. But now that situation has eased where I am from. But in smaller cities, especially in the interiors of the country, these numbers are going up because you may be aware that there was a mass migration that happened when the lockdown started from hotspots like Delhi and Mumbai back to the native places. Yep. And it seems that that infection is now catching up there.
Davina, I want to ask you, you mentioned some heads of state have tested positive, but what role does poverty and the caste system play in the pandemic there? Who's getting sick?
Although it seems to be impacting everybody around, I think the poor are the most vulnerable. In urban areas, there are slums where people live, sometimes families of about 10 to 12 people living in sort of an 8 by 8 foot room. They share community toilets. That's where you have the risk of getting the infection even more. Usually we've seen that people who live in slum areas are also those who do menial work. So people who'll come to clean toilets in your house, people who'll clean sewage in cities and drains in cities. And those are the people who are from the lower caste or the oppressed caste in India. That kind of work is only done by those people, unfortunately, and they are at risk. Having said that, I have seen that in areas like in Mumbai, which is among India's largest cities, you have one of Asia's largest slums. And over there, around 47,000 people have been tested. 20% who were found to have contracted were immediately quarantined in separate areas. So we've seen that in areas where large slums are there, authorities have been proactive in trying to stem the spread of infection, because essentially they don't, if you leave it up to these communities, they really don't have much of wherewithal to deal with it themselves.
Sure. Can you tell me a little bit more about restrictions? Are they still in place in the major cities and even the outskirts? Are shops and restaurants open right now? Are people wearing masks? Those types of things.
Shops, yes, they're open. Restaurants, yes, they're open. Gyms are and fitness centers are opening as well this week. But schools and colleges are still shut. I can tell you that there is a greater awareness among people to wear masks. But the weather here is so hot and humid at this time of the year. Mm-hmm. It's difficult for those who spend a lot of time outdoors to wear these masks. And although the restrictions have eased, many business owners are actually hesitant to do so. I mean, my neighborhood gym in Delhi, where I am from, they're allowed to open gym this week, and they're not doing so because the cost of opening the gym is so much with all the extra health precautions they have to do. They have to sanitize all the equipment. That means they have to hire more people. So it's not working out, even though there are efforts to come back to what we call normal in these times. We're quite away from it, I can tell you that.
That's the BBC's Devina Gupta in Delhi. Thank you so much for this update.
Thank you.
And as we continue bringing you primary results this week, at least 14 Republican candidates with links to QAnon have made their way into runoffs or onto the ballot this November. Now, you're either saying, wow, or what is QAnon? If it's the latter, you're not alone. A March Pew poll found that only 25% of Americans had ever heard of QAnon, a loosely organized movement centered around the belief that the U.S. is controlled by a cabal of child sex trafficking Democratic elites hell-bent on bringing down President Trump. And they believe these elites, led by Anthony Fauci, have gone so far as to manufacture the coronavirus to bring Trump down. They follow the cryptic online dispatches of someone named Q, who's anonymous, hence QAnon, who claims the highest government security clearance. QAnon adherents are young, old men, women. They show up at Trump rallies in Q merchandise, shirts and hats. President Trump has retweeted them. A quick primer, QAnon actually grew out of Pizzagate, the conspiracy theory ginned up in large part by Alex Jones, that, of course, falsely, ridiculously, claimed Hillary Clinton was running a child sex trafficking ring out of a D.C. pizza parlor. This so enraged one man that he picked up his assault rifle, stormed the restaurant, searching for children who, of course, were not there. Alex Kaplan from Media Matters has been tracking QAnon for a while now. So, Alex, Pizzagate was in 2016. How did QAnon grow out of this? Because Q didn't show up online till a year later.
Right. So QAnon is its own far-right conspiracy theory that started on a message board site called 4chan, which is kind of well-known for hosting white nationalists and white supremacists. And in late 2017, someone claiming to have Q clearance in the government that called itself Q, claimed to have some inside scoop that President Trump was working with then Special Counsel Robert Mueller to take down the deep state, Trump's perceived enemies, and this kind of global cabal of pedophiles and sex traffickers. And so that part of it was kind of like a bridge from what Pizzagate mm-hmm. was, which was also regarding like this secret sex trafficking ring that was about a pizzeria, and has taken off from there.
Well, again, you know, some of the crazy theories that John Kennedy Jr. didn't die in a plane crash. He's working behind the scenes for Donald Trump, or he is Q. Some of them are disgusting. We can't, you know, mention some of them, but some of them are just so peculiar that Michelle Obama secretly is a man. Crazy making, but the FBI considers QAnon to be a dangerous extremist group capable of carrying out violent attacks.
Yeah, it's been linked to multiple violent incidents. So some murders. There was a man who blockaded the Hoover Dam, who was armed, who was a QAnon supporter. There have been multiple attempted kidnappings tied to QAnon supporters. And as you said, last year, an FBI field office released a memo that mentioned QAnon as a potential domestic terror threat.
So what do you make of the fact that QAnon seems to have picked up speed this summer? 10 times as many Google searches in July as January, a 200% increase in positive tweets, many of which the president himself has retweeted. You know, what do you make of that surge? And how would you describe the Trump administration's relationship to QAnon?
Yeah, so I think the coronavirus is a big reason why. I think, you know, we're at home more, we're in quarantine, we have more time to be online, more time to be on social media, more time to Google stuff, and I think that's leading people down rabbit holes. At the same time, I think maybe some people, as a result of the pandemic, are feeling frustrated, worried, scared, want answers. They want to try to make sense of what's going on, and that may be leading them to QAnon as well. And regarding the Trump administration, there's been people in Trump's orbit that have amplified QAnon content in some manner, whether intentionally or unintentionally, such as, I'll name a couple of examples, Dan Scavino, President Trump's social media advisor, has winked at QAnon. He, for example, a few months ago posted on Facebook a photo that had a Q in it, and I was able to tell that he got it from a QAnon supporter on Facebook. Like, they had sent him the photo beforehand. Eric Trump, Trump's son, recently posted on Instagram a QAnon graphic, which he then took down without any explanation. It was a clear QAnon graphic. And Trump, as you mentioned, Trump himself has amplified QAnon promoting accounts many, many times, at least 90 times since the pandemic began specifically. And some of those tweets that he's amplified have sometimes had QAnon stuff directly in the tweet, or they have QAnon stuff that identifies them clearly supporting QAnon right at their profile.
Yeah. Well, the union chief of the Sergeants Benevolent Association in New York, doing a Fox interview, recently had a QAnon mug in the background. Another official greeted Mike Pence on a tarmac. There was a Q patch on his sleeve. Describe how Q and others, you know, in the movement direct the followers to think about science and to think about the media.
Well, Q basically tells people that the media is false. So there is a phrase often used by QAnon supporters that they often say, we are the news now, that they're the researchers, they're identifying what's really going on as opposed to the media lying to you.
Well, not just the media lying to you, but there seems to be some overlap with evangelicals, in part because both evangelicals and QAnon supporters seem to believe we're on the cusp of a great awakening. This is the phrase that's being used, and something's going to happen. Adrian Hahn, a game designer, says QAnon reminds him of an immersive multiplayer game, and he's worried people could recreate the playbook. Your thoughts?
Yeah, there's a term that sometimes I think people have used disparagingly for things like QAnon. They call it a LARP, like a real-life role-playing game. And I think that's kind of what that's getting at, that, you know, QAnon kind of puts what's going on in some ways in your hands, right? Like, you can do the research, you can feel involved, you can feel like you're making, can explain and figure out what's really going on behind the scenes, can make sense of the supposed maybe what seems like chaos going around the world.
There's a saying, we do the research. In other words, you can't argue a QAnon follower out of anything. They will just say, do your own research. What about Republican congressional candidates who are QAnon adherents? Now, some newsrooms don't want to draw attention to these conspiracy theories to inflate them. What's your thinking about how QAnon-believing candidates should be covered?
So I think it absolutely needs to be covered. I think it should be pretty front and center for every candidate that has even winked at this conspiracy theory. I mean, there is a range, right, among these candidates. So not all of them are exactly the same. There's definitely been a range between the true believers and those that I would say are maybe using it for politically beneficial reasons. But no matter what, for all of them, you want to question. You want to ask, why do you believe this, or impress them on it? I mean, the fact that they could even be winking, if not flat-out support, this conspiracy theory that has been, as we mentioned, you know, flagged by the FBI, tied to violence, and has been involved in countless misinformation campaigns online and on and social media raises red flags because I think it really gets to these candidates' judgment.
Yeah. And one last question. People have pointed to the Jeffrey Epstein story as proof that, you know, young women are being trafficked. That's what he was accused of doing when he killed himself. But Donald Trump was friends with Jeffrey Epstein, was photographed with him at different events, and with his girlfriend, who's now in jail. How do these QAnon followers, many, as we said, with religious end times beliefs, how do they see Donald Trump as the savior?
I guess they're, I mean, it does seem like they're kind of, in some ways, selectively choosing kind of what fits how they feel. I will say that, you know, things with conspiracy theories is that sometimes they are based off a kernel of truth, right? There is no denying that there has been sex trafficking in the world. And obviously what happened at Epstein's is extremely serious. That said, the conspiracy theory started before Epstein. What happened with Epstein does not mean QAnon is true. It's still baseless. But they will choose to use certain things to claim that the conspiracy theory is correct. And Q has, I will note, Q has mentioned Jeffrey Epstein multiple times to try to connect Democrats to this, you know, because the part of the conspiracy theory is that Democrats are part of this cabal, this, you know, this global sex trafficking ring. So Epstein's been used to push that by Q as well.
Alex Kaplan from Media Matters giving us a primer on QAnon. Alex, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me on.
It's here and now. Let's check in now on efforts to resume sports during this pandemic. The Major League Baseball season is now underway, but some games involving the Miami Marlins and St. Louis Cardinals were postponed because of outbreaks on the teams. Mike Pesca is a sports analyst for Here and Now. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. And Mike, give us an update on baseball. How are these outbreaks on the Marlins and Cardinals affecting the season?
Well, those two teams canceled games. It's doubtful they'll make them up. There was also an outbreak. I want to be careful. There was also two reported corona cases among the Philadelphia Phillies staff, but it didn't seem to spread to players or much of the team. And so the Marlins were in action as a home team in Baltimore the other night, last night, and the Cardinals should be back in action now. But what it really was a wake-up call that baseball, which was allowing teams essentially, they're not bubbling as the other teams and other leagues are, allowing teams to call its own shots as far as protocols, realized that this wasn't enough. They came out with stricter, tougher protocols governing the actions of players when they're not on the field, because especially with the Marlins, this seemed to, a night out in Atlanta seems to have given rise to the outbreak. But I do have to say, when you watch the games, there was a lot of attention to 100 or so extra rules that would govern baseball this year. No high-fiving, no spitting. But you watch the games, and there's high-fiving all about. Now, I know that high-fiving in an outdoor environment is not a big spreader of the virus, but it did underline to me that there was a disconnect between how serious this is on paper and how serious the players were going to take it. And that's what they're finding out now with these shutdowns.
Yeah, I mean, it's about perception as viewers watch these games. Let's talk basketball. The NBA, WNBA, and the National Hockey League have all resumed their seasons. So far, so good for them?
So far, so very good. Now, these sports can bubble. They have fewer players, although hockey has quite a large number of players on a team. But they're playing their seasons on both coasts of Canada. The playoffs have resumed. It's going well in hockey. WNBA, not as many players as the NBA, also going well. And the NBA just announced that it's 350-some-odd players, no corona tests since the bubble started. There were two players who came in who were positive, and they quarantined. So it's going extremely well, and it's an extremely interesting season. They've tweaked the rules a little bit to have play-in games. I think that experiment, especially as contrasted to baseball, are the two opposite ends of the spectrum about how sports leagues can and are handling this.
I want to talk with you about something else that's having an impact, and that's the Black Lives Matter movement. President Trump says, When players kneel during the anthem, it makes him stop watching the games or want to. Here's what Lakers star LeBron James said about that yesterday. Let's listen.
The game will go on without his eyes on it. I can sit here and speak for all of us that love the game of basketball. We could care less.
Mike, there's so much unusual about this year. I wonder if this politics and sports mixing is going to play a major role in the actual presidential election.
Well, I think to some extent the president would like it to be, because in the past he had some wins in his sail for picking fights with Colin Kaepernick and the NFL. But things have changed so much, and this is reflected in the polling of even, you know, suburban Americans and their attitudes, white Americans and their attitudes towards Black Lives Matter. So it seems that President Trump, to get political for a second, is using a play from a couple-year-old playbook that will not serve him well. But beyond that, I think what LeBron's saying, that we'll be fine without the president watching. That's so true as to almost be not necessarily stated, right? It is clear that the president's time and attention watching the NBA has almost no impact on the NBA. I wouldn't think the president would want to watch a sport where the players have been outfitted with new jerseys, where instead of their names, their surnames on the back of the jerseys, you have words like Black Lives Matter and vote and equality and liberty. This doesn't seem to be, I guess, in the wheelhouse of President Donald Trump's interest.
With the time I have with you, what are the prospects for professional and college football this season?
Well, college football, I think it's a question of hope over experience. They're going ahead, especially the big power conferences that make a lot of money are going ahead. But players in the Pac-12 have objected. One team in major college football, UConn, has opted out of the season, but they're going to try to play limited schedules. And the NFL, today, this afternoon, is the deadline for players to opt out. About 60 or so have. Teams like the New England Patriots, many of their players have opted out. The best case scenario is it's going to be a different and truncated season.
Wow, so much to follow and so much to not follow when it comes to sports at this moment. Mike Pesca is here and now, sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast The Gist at slate.com. Mike, as always, thanks.
You're welcome.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.
Democratic primary in Missouri saw a longtime incumbent ousted by progressive Democrat and Black Lives Matter activist Cori Bush.
They counted us out. They called me, you know, I'm just the protester. Uh-huh. I'm just the activist. But St. Louis showed up today, so.
We'll talk with Bush about her plans for Missouri. That's next time on Here and Now.